Hello, everybody. Today is Friday, July 1st. I'm Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we will take a look at the pictures on the front page of the papers. On the front page of the Times, the main picture is in front of the Supreme Court building out on the lawn. And basically is a picture of the broadcasters setting up for their broadcast. One man standing in front of the camera, another person sitting down. We're going to have a story on that right after I finish describing the pictures. And over to the Hartford Courant at Bradley International Airport, there's a new skywalk that connects the terminal to the $210 million transportation center. And there's a picture of the skywalk, beautiful skywalk, person walking through it. Underneath it, there are two pictures. One is a picture of the escalators at Bradley International, and another a picture of the parking garage in the parking lot. And it says that the completion of the $210 million Transportation Center at Bradley International was marked with a ceremony Thursday. It will be open to the public July 13th. The center will add 850 parking spaces. All right, we're going to go to the first story I have from the New York Times. The Supreme Court on Thursday limited the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate carbon emissions from power plants, making it much tougher for President Biden to achieve his goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions in half by the end of the decade. The vote was 6-3, with the court's three liberal justices in dissent, saying that the majority had stripped the EPA of the power to respond to the most pressing environmental challenge of our time. In ruling against the EPA, the Supreme Court again waded into a politically diverse, divisive issue on the final day of a blockbuster term, adding to the conservative supermajority's decisions to eliminate the constitutional right to abortion, vastly expand gun rights, and further erode the wall separating church and state. Implications of the ruling could extend well beyond environmental policy. Also signals that the court's newly expanded conservative majority is deeply skeptical of the power of administrative agencies to address major issues facing the nation and the planet. The decision set off criticism from the left, but voices from the coal industry and conservative states praised the ruling. The decision left Mr. Biden with far fewer tools to fight climate change, and he said the ruling was another devastating decision, this is a quote, that aims to take our country backwards, unquote. The president vowed to take action even as the court limited his ability to act, adding we cannot and will not ignore the danger to public health and existential threat the climate crisis poses. Patrick Morrisey, the Attorney General of West Virginia and one of the leaders of the challenge to the EPA's authority, welcomed the decision. EPA can no longer sidestep Congress to exercise broad regulatory power that would radically transform the nation's energy grid and force states to fundamentally shift their energy portfolios away from coal-fired generation, he said. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. only glancingly alluded to the harms caused by climate change. Justice Elena Kagan began her dissent with a long passage detailing the devastation the planet faces, including hurricanes, floods, famines, coastal erosion, mass migration, and political crises. The question in the case, Chief Justin Roberts wrote, turned on the scope of the language of the Clean Air Act. Under it, he wrote, Congress had not clearly given the agency sweeping authority to regulate the energy industry, capping carbon dioxide emissions at a level that will force a nationwide transition away from the use of coal to generate electricity may be a sensible solution to the crisis of the day, he wrote, quoting an earlier decision. But he added, a decision of such magnitude and consequence rests with Congress itself or an agency acting pursuant to a clear delegation from that representative body. In dissent, Justice Kagan wrote that the court has substituted its own policy judgment for that of Congress. Whatever else this court may know about, it does not have a clue about how to address climate change, she wrote. And let's say the obvious, the stakes here are high, yet the court today prevents congressionally authorized agency action to curb power plants' carbon dioxide emissions. The court appoints itself instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. She wrote, I cannot think of many things more frightening. The ruling curtailed, but not eliminate, the agency's ability to regulate the energy sector, and the agency may still use measures like emission controls at individual power plants, but the court ruled out more ambitious approaches like a cap-and-trade system. It has also expressed skepticism toward the reach of other regulatory agencies, evident in recent decisions arising from the coronavirus pandemic. The court has ruled, for instance, that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was not authorized to impose a moratorium on evictions, and that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration was powerless to tell large employers to have their workers vaccinated or undergo frequent testing. The question before the justices in the new case, West Virginia versus Environmental Protection Agency number 201530, was whether the Clean Air Act allowed the EPA to issue sweeping regulations across the power sector. More broadly, the court was asked to address whether Congress must speak with particular clarity when it authorizes executive agencies to address major political and economic questions. That theory is often referred to as the major questions doctrine, and it played a key role in Thursday's decision. Chief Justice Roberts, employing the phrase for the first time in a majority opinion, said it applied in cases of unusual significance and was meant to address, quote, a particular and recurring problem, agencies asserting highly consequential power beyond what Congress could reasonably be understood to have granted. Moving over now to the Hartford Courant, I have the story of the new skywalk at Bradley International from Windsor Locks. Bradley International Airport soon will mark the end of time-wasting shuttle bus rides for travelers picking up rental cars, a significant milestone celebrated Thursday with the completion of the airport's $210 million ground transportation center. All the airport's rental car companies, now scattered in and around Bradley, will be consolidated in 2 weeks at the transportation center connected to the terminal by a skywalk. At a ceremony in the space Thursday and attended by dozens, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said the airport forms a potent first impression both for leisure and business travelers. The ease of securing a rental car is so crucial it can play a role in a company's decision to locate in Connecticut in the Hartford area, Murphy said. This is going to pay immediate dividends when it comes to marketing the state, when it comes to the governor's efforts to bring new companies to this state, Murphy said, as well as providing a much better experience for families coming to visit loved ones here and Connecticut residents as well. Governor Ned Lamont hailed the massive structure for the time it will save travelers and build on the addition of multiple nonstop destinations at Bradley since the start of the pandemic. Speed matters, Lamont said. It makes a big difference. What an incredible introduction this is. Construction on the Transportation Center began 3 years ago, and work continued through the pandemic. The project was financed by the sale of bonds by the Connecticut Airport Authority, a quasi-public agency that operates Bradley, but the debt will be paid off by user fees collected by the car rental companies, which include Hertz, Enterprise, Avis, and Budget. The user fees are $8.40 a day, the authority said. Kevin A. Dillon, the authority's executive director, said the transportation center will contribute to major environmental benefits, eliminating 250,000 bus trips each year. And the rental car companies will be making a significant investment in electric charging stations so they can ultimately convert their fleet to electric, Dillon said, another plus. Dillon said he also foresees redevelopment potential in the next few years for land on Schofester Road, where many of the car rental companies now have their lots. But here are seven things to know about this new transportation center. First, when does it open to the public? The answer is July 13. How big is the transportation center? The transportation center is 1.4 million square feet, almost 200,000 square feet larger than West Farms Mall on the West Hartford Farmington line. How do I reach the transportation center after arriving in the terminal? A skywalk connects the terminal to the transportation center. The skywalk leads to the third level of the transportation center, where Enterprise, National, and Alamo are located. The level above hosts Hertz, Dollar, and Thrifty. The floor below, Avis, Budget, and Payless. How many rental cars can the new transportation center accommodate? answer is up to 2,300. Each level has vacuuming and car washing stations that can turn around returned rentals in 15 to 20 minutes, according to Bob Bruno, the authority's director of engineering. How do you exit once you have your rental car? A ramp in the shape of a helix on the western side of Center leads to a highway entrance that eventually leads to I-91. A second helix on the eastern side is for the return of the rentals. Is there additional parking incorporated in the transportation center? Yes, there are 850 spaces divided between the ground level of the transportation center and an adjacent covered lot. The daily rate is $25 for the covered parking, and the rate for the lot has not yet been determined, the authority said. The authority now operates about 8,000 parking spaces at the airport, with 3,500 in the existing garage. The spaces in the transportation center, representing a 10% increase, will be used if the garage, connected by a short access road to the transportation center, is filled, Bruno said. Finally, are there connections to public transportation? The transportation center will eventually house bus arrivals and departures, providing connections to trains. A final timetable has not been determined. It is hoped that the transportation center also will have a direct connection in the future to a light rail spur of the Hartford Line. And we're going to go back to the front page of The Current. Governor Ned Lamont announced Thursday he will appoint a retired career state employee who handled election matters in the state attorney general's office to succeed Secretary of the State Denise Merrill. Mark E. Kohler, K-O-H-L-E-R, of North Haven, retired early this year following a 30-year career in the office of the Attorney General, most recently as an Associate Attorney General. From 2011 to 2021, he headed the Special Litigation Department that represents the state's constitutional officers, legislature, and judiciary, with responsibilities over election matters, charities, gambling, and federal Indian tribal issues, officials said. The Secretary of State is Connecticut's chief elections officer, who helps establish and administer rules to guide voting by mail procedures. Merrill, 73, stepped down Thursday, 6 months before her term ends, to care for her husband. She announced last year she will not seek a fourth term. Kohler will take the job July 11th and remain in office until the next Secretary of State, who will be elected in November, takes over in January. Lamont said he is pleased Kohler agreed to step away briefly from his retirement. Kohler's experience in the Attorney General's office will benefit him as Secretary of the State, the governor said. Mark is incredibly well-respected, is a level-headed, tactful, and experienced attorney who has a considerable understanding of Connecticut state statutes, particularly those concerning the operations of our elections and government administration, he said. Attorney General William Tong said Kohler knows our state election laws inside and out. He's unflappable and a manager who oversaw the deluge of litigation defending our election laws and executive orders during COVID-19. Mark Kohler is the absolute best choice to fill this role in this critical moment. He was one of the biggest brains in our office and knows our state's election laws inside and out, Tong said. State Representative Terry Wood, Republican of Darien, a candidate for the Republican nomination for Secretary of State, said Kohler has no public record and has worked in a very activist attorney general's office staffed primarily by Democrats. It doesn't give me a lot of confidence, she said. A spokesman in the Secretary of State's office did not respond to an email asking for an interview with Kohler. Lamont, who is seeking a second term, followed his own playbook in avoiding partisanship in selecting constitutional officers. Choosing a Secretary of the State who will not seek election ensures that this short-term appointment be clear of politics, he said. In December, Lamont appointed Natalie Braswell, a former high-ranking official in the Comptroller's office, to complete the term of Comptroller Kevin P. Lembo, who resigned for health reasons. With both picks, Lamont selected veteran state employees who will not be political candidates for their jobs. The governor passed over Deputy Secretary of State Scott Bates, a national security expert who worked for several members of Congress, and then Governor Douglas Wilder of Virginia. He was a board member and chairman of the Connecticut Port Authority until 2019, when he resigned in 2019 as the agency faced criticism over spending practices.